Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Surviving the Days Ahead. I'm your host, Reverend Deborah Marshall. Today we are going to have a COVID-19 update, and then we will talk about wildfires, wildfire survival, and tips for making a camp during a dry season, and also how to avoid starting a runaway fire when you camp. And we are going to also talk a little bit about, I found an article. I need to take lessons on how to speak clearly. Forgive me. I will have some more information about COVID-19 that I have not heard before. And I think that some of you may like to hear that. So I'm going to start out with the COVID-19 information, and then we're going to move on to fires, wildfires, and also how to build a good fire at a campsite. Now, let me see where we will start. First of all, I'm going to start with the COVID update. Now, in the U.S., we are now at 7,262,816 cases with 208,777 deaths. That represents, 7,262,816 cases represents an increase of 398,962 cases since the 20th. And as far as the deaths, it represents an increase of 6,368 deaths in 6-day period. Now, India, 5,979,197 cases with 94,433 deaths. Brazil, 4,694,648 cases with 140,783 deaths. Russia, 1,143,571 cases with 20,225 deaths. Spain, 735,198 cases with 31,232 deaths. Turkey, 312,966 cases and 7,929 deaths. Italy, 308,104 cases with 223,693 deaths. Canada, 151,589 cases and 9,263 deaths. The Netherlands, 108,631 cases with 6,366 deaths. The Netherlands, 108,631 cases with 6,366 deaths. United Arab Emirates, 90,618 cases with 411 deaths. China, 85,337 cases with 4,634 deaths. Ireland, 34,560 cases with 1,802 deaths. Denmark, 26,213 cases with 648 deaths. Greece, 17,228 cases with 376 deaths. New Zealand, 1,831 cases and 25 deaths. Globally, we are at 32,953,188 cases. And that represents, since 9/20, that represents an increase of 2,094,119 cases. New cases. And we are at 996,287 deaths, which represents an increase of 37,973 cases. So it is not over yet. I know you get tired of hearing me say that every week, but it is true. And it's something that we need to be aware of. Now, this is an interesting article, and I believe, let's see, yeah, this came out of, believe it or not, AARP. Rachel Nania is the, it was August 28th, and Rachel Nania is the one that wrote the article. I'm not going to read every single word, but it's showing on you talking about unusual symptoms for COVID-19. It says fever, cough, and shortness of breath are not the only warning sign of a coronavirus infection, even if they are the most common. In recent months, a growing number of doctors have documented a handful of otherwise unexpected symptoms. Some are reporting red or purple lesions on patients' hands and feet. Others are treating people with diarrhea and severe appetite loss. They are also patients who have lost their sense of taste and smell. These symptoms, strange as they may seem, reinforce what experts around the world have come to realize in recent weeks, that the COVID-19 virus is capable of causing more than a respiratory illness. It can launch a full body attack. And I think that, basically the scientists know that. They've, you know, I told you about that article. It was rather involved and very technical, but it did point to the fact that it does actually, it does attack every system in your body. It's unbelievable. It takes a while for the full range of symptoms to be known when you're dealing with a new virus, explains Lisa Winston, MD, an epidemiologist and professor of clinical medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. At the start of the U.S. outbreak, the focus was primarily on treating the sick patients, many of whom experienced classical respiratory symptoms and needed help breathing. But as time went on, and people saw more cases, they started to recognize some of the things that are a bit less typical. COVID toes. If you have asked dermatologist Esther Freeman, MD, last year what type of skin ailment a future viral pandemic might bring about, she never would have guessed red and purple colored toes that swell, burn, and itch. But that's exactly what she and other experts are seeing in patients with coronavirus infections, leading this unusual symptom to be dubbed COVID toes. The good news is they do go away, says Freeman, director of Massachusetts General Hospital Global Health Dermatology and assistant professor of dermatology at Harvard Medical School, who is also overseeing an international registry that catalogs dermatological manifestations of COVID-19. And they're saying it's not permanent. Another plus, the majority of people with the so-called COVID toes, which Freeman likens to chilblains, also called pernio, an inflammatory skin condition that often occurs after exposure to very cold temperatures. They don't experience other symptoms of a corona infection and don't require hospitalization for care. Many patients are developing these toe lesions well after their infection, or they're otherwise completely asymptomatic except for the toes, which is bizarre. Though most cases of COVID toes occur in the feet, the hands can be affected also. Rashes similar to those that result from hives and chicken pox have also been reported in people who test positive for the coronavirus. As for how and why these skin lesions conditions are happening, Freeman says, our knowledge on this is still evolving. Could be an inflammatory response to the virus, for example, or even a result of small clots, blood clots in the blood vessels of the skin. I think that over coming months, we're going to learn a lot more about why this is happening. If you notice a lesion like rash on your hands or feet, contact your doctor or dermatologist about your symptoms, since it could signify a coronavirus infection. That said, it's important to keep in mind that not everything on your toes right now is from COVID. There's certainly lots of things that can appear on feet, and there's things that can even look similar, which is why it's important to talk to an expert. There's no specific treatment for that rash on the toes, but a high-potency topical steroid might reduce the inflammation. One thing to note, however, is that a doctor won't be able to tell if the virus is still active in your body just by looking at your skin. So the safest thing to do is to follow CDC guidelines for self-isolation, and to discuss with your board-certified dermatologist or other physician whether COVID testing might be right for you. Diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, and severe appetite loss. COVID-19 is producing symptoms of diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, and appetite loss in a number of patients, young and old. A recent study out of Stanford University of Medicine found that that nearly one-third of 116 patients infected with the virus reported mild GI symptoms. Earlier reports showed that among roughly 200 patients in China, more than half experienced diarrhea, nausea, and vomiting. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have also acknowledged GI issues on the on its list of COVID-19 warning signs. There's no question at this point that GI symptoms can be a manifestation of COVID-19, says William Shea, professor of gastroenterology and nutrition sciences at the University of Michigan. And oftentimes these symptoms can come on even in the absence of the more typical and recognized markers of a coronavirus infection, such as fever and cough. Experts point to a few explanations for the stomach trouble. Shea says a virus can directly infect the cells that line the GI tract, which is why some patients can test positive for the virus with a stool sample. Now, that's something different. They can actually test positive with a stool specimen rather than with the nose swabs that they and blood tests, even if results from a nasal swab come back negative. GI issues could also be an indirect result of the body's fight against infection. So if you don't have a history of GI trouble and experience a sudden onset of diarrhea, nausea, and vomiting or loss of appetite with or without other COVID symptoms, check in with your doctor. Your symptoms might warrant a test. And if you are diagnosed with COVID-19, consider confining yourself to your own room and your own bathroom if possible. Excuse me, please. Shea says it's not yet clear whether the virus can be transmitted fecal orally. It sounds disgusting, but what it is in a bathroom, let me put it this way. If you can smell something, you have particles of it in the air. That's how you smell it. So that's what smell is you're smelling particles of that substance in the air. So particles from feces, the E. coli, and all of that, is probably pretty much everywhere in your bathroom, which is one reason why it's a really wise idea to cover your toothbrush and to not use the towel rack over your commode because it's a really stupid place to put one. Note to builders, stop doing it. Put a shelf instead so you can put things like toilet paper up on the shelf rather than a towel rack. But anyway, as I said, because they don't know for sure if that's possible, you should not be sharing a toilet with someone that has COVID-19 unless, obviously, you have no other choice. Also, disinfect bathroom surfaces often, especially high-touch areas such as the toilet and sink handles. Don't share toilet paper rolls with someone who has COVID-19 and always flush with the cover closed. You should do that anyway to minimize the spread of germs. Every time you flush, you can be throwing bacteria all over your bathroom. You should always keep the lid down and put it down before you flush. Finally, continue to be vigilant about personal hygiene. The whole issue about meticulous hand washing is so unbelievably important, especially if the virus is spread by the fecal-oral route, Shea emphasizes. People need to wash their hands and not touch their face. Loss of taste or smell. On the CDC's recently expanded list of common COVID-19 symptoms, one newcomer stands out. In addition to the fever and chills and sore throat, the public health agency recognizes new loss of taste or smell as evidence of a coronavirus infection. You normally can get that with a bad head cold, for instance, where you have a lot of congestion. But it's happening with COVID. A study published in the journal Nature Medicine tracked more than 2.5 million participants who reported their potential symptoms of COVID-19 on a smartphone app. About 65% of the people who tested positive for COVID-19 reported loss of taste and smell, making it one of the strongest predictors of the illness among those studied. Similarly, researchers from the University of California, San Diego, found that the smell and taste loss were reported in 68 and 71% of COVID-19 positive subjects, respectively. But we don't always ask those questions when we are in the busy emergency room. Zinki Dong, MD, Director of the Institute of Healthcare Policy and Aging Research at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. When triaging patients, many healthcare workers have been focused on the primary symptoms that they know to ask. So you might, if you notice a change in taste and smell, make sure your doctor knows it. This is starting to change. It says neurological effects complicate diagnosis in older victims, but this is starting to change. Loss of taste and smell, which usually return after the virus runs its course, are two symptoms on a growing list of neurological effects doctors are noting in COVID-19 patients. Other indicators of the illness include dizziness, headache, and confusion. And I would imagine that could be worse in the elderly. In fact, a study of JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA Neurology, found that more than 36% of 214 patients in Wuhan, China, experienced neurological symptoms during their bout with COVID-19. So the dizziness and all of that also. For older adults in particular, these neurological effects can be just as devastating as pulmonary impacts of a coronavirus infection, Dong says. They can also be easily overlooked or dismissed as dementia or other diseases common with aging. And there's nothing much more irritating than to have doctors who refuse to listen if a family member is present and says, yes, that person is elderly, but no, they're never confused. And, you know, all of a sudden they're confused. The doctors take a look and they say they're confused, but they're probably confused all the time. And when my mother was with me, I had that kind of thing happen, and they didn't want me in the room. They wanted to talk only to her. But I knew she was confused, I wasn't talking over top of them or anything. I was letting them do the interview, but I was also telling them things that I knew, that I saw. And if she said anything that wasn't right, I would tell them, you know, I would correct it. But doctors sometimes do that because they don't want someone else to get in the way when they're interviewing the patient. But you ought to listen to caregivers because they know the mental status of that patient better than you do. So, you know, unfortunately, it can be overlooked as just, hey, they're just confused anyway. And doctors need to try a little harder to find out if that's the case. Neil Sicca, MD, an associate professor of emergency medicine at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., says broader coronavirus testing is key to distinguishing COVID-19 patients from those who are suffering from a stroke or experiencing a complication from an underlying health condition. We are trying to be very vigilant and broad in our thinking. When a patient comes into the emergency room with confusion or change in mental status, Sicca says, that could be some other type of infection. It definitely could also be a presentation of COVID. And so we are trying to do rapid testing on those patients to identify them early. Let's see. It says, you know, we started by thinking about COVID as very similar to SARS or MERS, you know, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, which are two other respiratory illnesses caused by coronaviruses. But this, there's something different about this virus, Dong says. We're catching up now. But if we had focused on just fever, not just fever, shortness of breath, and dry cough, I think we might have caught more potential symptoms much earlier, especially in vulnerable older adults. Blood clots. Healthcare professionals are taking note of a troubling trend among coronavirus patients, blood clots. some studies have found that as many as 30% of people with severe cases of COVID-19 experience clotting complications. Now, this is one of the things that Chinese research paper that I told you about before, that was one of the things they found out almost immediately, was how fast, how many blood clots, and they even identified the mechanism by which this happens. COVID-19 experienced clotting complications. Clot specialist Alex Spiropoulos, MD, estimates that the number is even higher. The internist and professor of medicine at the Donald and Barbara Zucker School of Medicine at Hofstra Northwell says that as many as 40% who are hospitalized because of coronavirus infection die from blood clots, including microclots and the destruction they can cause, heart attack, stroke, lung damage, and the like. The risk of blood clots are anywhere from about 3 to 6-fold or greater, more than we are used to seeing, Spiropoulos adds. It has us all in the academic community a little bit befuddled because it's one of the most aggressive diseases with respect to blood clots that we've seen. As for what's behind the clots, the answer is still unclear. They may be directly caused by the coronavirus and its interaction with the clotting pathway, Spiropoulos says. A hyperimmune response is another explanation experts are exploring. Then there's the state of being critically ill, which Babak Navi, MD, Division Chief for Stroke and Hospital Neurology at Weill Cornell Medical College, and a neurologist at New York Presbyterian Hospital, says can provide provoke clotting. It's well known that infections and inflammations are potent triggers and risk factors for clotting events, including stroke, Navi explains. If you have clotting issues, the best you can do, especially during the corona outbreak, is to take your blood thinner medication as prescribed, and make sure you get your make sure you get your blood tested as prescribed also. Don't just keep taking it and not go to a doctor, because you can get in trouble that way as well. And if you experience symptoms of a blood clot, like pain, redness, or swelling, or a stroke, such as confusion, dizziness, and numbness, take them extremely seriously and go right to the emergency department. Researchers are exploring whether blood thinners could be a more routine course of care among hospitalized COVID-19 patients. A study out of New York's Mount Sinai Health System found that patients who were treated with anticoagulants had improved outcomes, both in and out of the intensive care unit. Now, hearing loss is something else that they haven't talked about before. Researchers are now looking into the possible connection between COVID-19 and hearing loss. Several reports document patients who have experienced hearing problems that coincide with COVID-19 diagnosis. Often these issues, which include tinnitus or ringing in the ears, persist even after other symptoms of the illness subside. The virus has also been detected in the middle ear of COVID-19 patients, as reported in JAMA Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery. With several other viruses known to cause hearing loss, the study's corresponding author, C. Matthew Stewart, said the findings raise some concerns. If there is an active viral infection in that part of the body, you could get the whole host of symptoms associated with other types of viral infections in that area, including inflammation in the ear that could impair hearing or cause tinnitus, dizziness, and imbalance, explained Stewart, professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Experts caution that there's not enough evidence yet to draw a direct link between COVID-19 infection and hearing problems. Other factors, such as medicines used to treat COVID, many of which are toxic to the ear, could contribute to the complication. And that's going to confound our understanding of the difference between hearing loss that's caused by a viral infection or hearing loss caused by the usage of the ototoxic medication. Being critically ill can also usher in hearing loss, researchers point out, and public health efforts such as masks and physical distancing recommended to slow the spread of the virus can reveal previously overlooked hearing issues. Let's see, Elias Michaelides, MD, director of the Cochlear Implant Program and medical director of audiology and otolaryngology at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, has seen a number of patients in recent months who said their hearing has worsened since the start of the pandemic. It turns out that their hearing hasn't changed, but their ability to communicate with others has, he says. When you're wearing a mask, it muffles your voice and sometimes can make it harder for people to hear you. If you've ever noticed some elderly people, they're kind of looking at your mouth while you're talking. They're reading your lips. They might not even know they're doing it. So if you got a mask on your face and they can't see your lips, then they're at a disadvantage because they're not hearing you well enough to understand what you're saying. So let me see. If you experience worsening or sudden hearing loss, contact your doctor right away. Early treatment can prevent permanent damage in some instances, Michaelides says. Your doctor may also recommend tools such as hearing aids to improve your quality of life. And I will give you an opinion. I am not someone who knows all about hearing aids, but my opinion is that these cheaper products that are amplifying sound, that are being marketed on television, and I'm not giving any names of products. I'm not trying to get myself a lawsuit here. But in my opinion, you would be wiser to go to a reputable audiologist and, you know, a doctor that specializes in your ear care and be tested and go that route, rather than to buy these cheaper things that actually, if you use them incorrectly, you turn them up too loud, you do various things, you can actually injure your ear and create a greater hearing loss. So be careful with things like that. If you use them as, on as low a setting as you can, so that you so that it's not so loud that you're actually hurting your ears further. Because there are different kinds of hearing loss. Now, COVID-19 updates. Thousands protest the lockdown measures in London. The largest U.S. ministry reservation has ordered residents to stay home or face fines. Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India pledges his country's vaccine industry will help all humanity. Right now, officials in South Dakota and Minnesota report single-day records for new infections. Both states have recorded more cases over the past week than over any other seven-day stretch throughout the pandemic. I'm not fond of lockdowns, and I'm not fond of having to wear masks. No one is. But I think you have to have enough sense to understand that it's a simple and not so expensive way of protecting yourself, washing hands, wearing a mask, making sure your children do the same. If the government thinks that it's bad enough that you need to lock down, you should listen to them. Thousands gather in London to protest lockdown measures and question the official virus narrative. Thousands of unmasked demonstrators flouted social distancing rules and gathered in central London on Saturday to protest new lockdown measures. The protesters chanted freedom and called to end the crazy rules as some held signs declaring no more lies, no more masks, no more lockdown. A day earlier, Britain reported its highest daily number of new infections since the pandemic began, nearly 6,900, and 34 new deaths, bringing the country's toll of lives lost to the virus to nearly 42,000. Conspiracy theories undermining authorities' warnings of the danger of contagion are gaining traction, and various news organizations have reported that QAnon movement that began in the United States is taking root, as it has in Germany. Overall, Britain has been the hardest hit country in Europe, though its current seven-day average of new infections per capita is far lower than the averages of Spain and France. But with its daily raw numbers rising sharply over recent weeks, the authorities are reimposing lockdown measures. More than 20 million people are set to be affected by new measures on Sunday night as numerous parts of the northern and central England, as well as Wales, go under tighter restrictions. Bars and restaurants must close at 10 p.m. in England, and in countless areas, household visits and gatherings have been restricted. And London Mayor Khan urged Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and I think he had COVID-19 and may have been on a respirator. I'm not sure about that, but I believe he had it, to ban household visits to the city's 9 million inhabitants, and the city has been placed on the government's watch list. 15 police officers were injured in lockdown protests earlier this month, and on Saturday, local authorities said they would not tolerate any violence against law enforcement. I know there is great frustration to these regulations, but they have been designated to keep everyone safe from what is a lethal virus, said Adelikhan, a commander of the Metropolitan Police, who was leading Saturday's operation. By flagrantly gathering in large numbers and ignoring social distancing, you are putting your health and the health of your loved ones at risk. And that's what I've been saying about all of the people around here running around without masks. Now, Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India said in his annual United Nations General Assembly address Saturday that his country's vast vaccine production industry would serve the world in fighting the coronavirus pandemic. So they are working very hard. As the largest vaccine-producing country of the world, I want to give one more assurance to the global community today, Mr. Modi said in a pre-recorded speech. India's vaccine production and delivery capacity will be used to help all humanity in fighting this crisis. So, I'm kind of skipping around here, because it's a very long article, so I'm trying not to bore you with all of the details in some of this. I'm trying to get to the most important part. Now, let's see. The world still has no proven coronavirus vaccine, but Chinese officials have nonetheless tried to inoculate tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people. Three vaccine candidates are being injected into workers whom the government considers essential, along with many others, including employees of the pharmaceutical firms. Officials are laying out plans to give shots to even more people, amounting to a big wager that the vaccines will eventually prove safe and effective. China's move has bewildered global experts. Many of the injections appear to be taking place outside the typical drug approval process. Yet the unproven vaccines could have harmful side effects, and ineffective vaccines could lead to a false sense of security and encourage behavior that can lead to even more infections. The wide use of vaccines also raises issues of consent. While China is racing the United States and other countries to develop a vaccine, its rivals are moving more cautiously. The U.S. companies have pledged to thoroughly vet a vaccine before wide use, despite the pressure from President Trump. Wait a minute here. I'm sorry. I had to do something with my screen. Despite pressure from President Trump to go faster. In Russia, the first country to approve a vaccine even before trials were completed, the authorities have yet to administer it to a large population, according to health officials and experts. Tao Lina, a Shanghai-based vaccine expert, said that part of the government's motivation was to test the public's willingness to take a vaccine. I suspect that China is having far greater illnesses and deaths because they have so many small villages and things that are, it's hard to get health care there and to get testing there. And I suspect they're doing it in a huge attempt to try to stop COVID from killing all so many people. In Australia, Minister for the State of Victoria resigned on Saturday after an inquiry into the causes of a second wave of infections in Melbourne. The state's premier had blamed the minister, Jenny Mikakos, for her role in a bungled quarantine program that allowed returning travelers to spread the virus via hotel security guards. Ms. Mikakos said in a statement announcing her resignation that she was deeply sorry for the situation that Victorians find themselves in, but she said it was not a result of her actions. Melbourne, Victoria's state capital, is expected to ease its lockdown rules on Monday. 2 months after reopening Asia's most popular tourist destination, the governor of Bali, Wayan Koster, disclosed this week that more than 20 workers at his official residence had tested positive for the coronavirus, including aides, a waiter, a gardener, and a typist. And his wife posted on an Instagram that she had tested positive, though was not suffering any symptoms. Excuse me. Now, here in the U.S., in the Navajo Nation, residents are ordered to stay home or face fines as high as $1,000 as cases surge again in that area. The Navajo Nation, the largest Native American reservation, has reinstated a full weekend lockdown to try to contain new spikes in infections. Weekend lockdowns help curb the spread of the virus after harrowing outbreaks earlier in the year, and the 57-hour lockdown that started 8 p.m. Friday will last through Monday at 5 a.m. Residents, I think the idea here is to probably keep people from forgetting social distancing and going to functions, you know, with your family and gatherings and all, where you could spread it. Residents were ordered to stay home or face fines as high as $1,000. Stores, restaurants, and businesses such as Hayvenders are prohibited to operate during the lockdown, and the measure also bans wood hauling, a common weekend activity this time of year. For authorities, the authorities said they would confiscate the firewood from violators. The nation has had more than 10,200 infections and 551 related deaths since the pandemic began. Months ago, when the virus first exploded on the reservation, leaders instituted full weekend lockdowns. Infections subsided, but they kept the restrictions from Saturday night through Monday morning. The reservation recently experienced a stretch of weeks with few or no new viral cases on some days, but then new clusters were detected and new daily cases reached 42 on Thursday, followed by 26 on Friday. Jonathan Nez, the Navajo Nation's president, said that contact tracers have found the new clusters to be connected to Navajo citizens who had contracted the virus after traveling off the reservation. All three of the states the nation is spread over, Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, are enduring high or rising rates of infection, and only New Mexico has had a statewide mask requirement. Please do not hold family gatherings, and please do not travel to hot spots off the Navajo Nation, Mr. Nez said in a statement after the new clusters were detected. Under 10% of the U.S. population has coronavirus antibodies. And that is not good news for people that think that we should have herd immunity, because that means we're not getting it. Less than 10% of the people in the United States have antibodies to the coronavirus, suggesting that the nation is even further from herd immunity than was previously estimated, according to a study published on Friday in The Lancet. The study looked at blood samples from 28,500 patients on dialysis in 46 states, the first such nationwide analysis. The results roughly matched those of an analysis to be released next week by the CDC, which found that about 10% of the blood samples from sites across the country contain antibodies to the virus. Dr. Robert Redfield, a director of the CDC, was referring to that analysis when he told a congressional committee this week that 90% of the people in the country were still vulnerable to the virus. Just please, everyone, wear your masks. You know, socially distance, wear your mask. Talk on the phone, you know, talk on Skype or whatever, you know, you can set up like that at a distance. You know, if you're going to have services, church services, either wear your mask and sit 6 feet apart or have them outside. And that's true of any group that you're going to get together with. Make sure you're 6 feet apart and have it outside. And if you have, say, a backyard cookout or whatever, you know, if you're smoking, viruses and bacteria can travel on smoke just like they can travel you know, if you spit when you talk or you sneeze and the droplets go everywhere. You know, so if you're with a lot of heavy smokers and they have their masks off and they're smoking, you're putting yourself at risk. You really are. Let me see. It says a judge in Texas blocked a change to the state's ballots that was years in the making, citing the pandemic. Only a handful of states still allow for straight ticket voting, the option of choosing a party's entire slate of candidates with one mark of the ballot. On Friday, just 3 weeks before the start of the early voting, a U.S. district judge in Texas blocked plans to fully eliminate the straight ticket option in the state, citing an interest in minimizing the time voters have to spend in the polling places amid a pandemic. The judge, Marina Garcia Molejo, said her ruling on Friday, that she feared that eliminating the practice would cause irreparable injury to voters by creating mass lines at the polls and increasing the amount of time voters are exposed to COVID-19. The Republican-controlled Texas legislature passed a law in 2017 eliminating straight-ticket voting beginning in 2020. While supporters said the move would force voters to make more informed choices, Democrats argued at the time that it was actually done to stem their party's growing margins for down-ballot races, particularly in the state's large cities. Democratic organizers filed a legal challenge in March of this year, arguing that the straight-ticket options save voters time. In some Texas urban counties, races for local and statewide candidates can force voters to pore over ballots that are several pages long. And so I'm not going to finish reading all of that. Please, along the lines of this being a voting year, please use your common sense. Really listen to what all the people are saying. And unfortunately, like most political elections these days, it's mudslinging more than anything else. But try to find out what each person represents. You know? Really take a look at the candidate that has the most experience in politics. And yes, I am a Democrat, and yes, I think that Mr. Biden is the one that we should be voting for because he is someone who has friends on both sides of the aisle. He is someone who is a politician who knows how to handle things. And yes, President Trump does have, he's had this term to learn, but he had to learn from scratch. And there have been a great many problems that we've had, and I still think that we should be looking at Joe Biden. But everybody has to vote their conscience. And I do hope that all of you will not just go into a voting place and just check something to be checking it and walk out. Really think about it before you go, okay? Now, we have someone on here. Let me check and see if they have questions. Oops, they hung up. Okay. The person that just hung up, you don't have to talk to be on here. If you want to just sit in and listen, that's fine too. Now, we're going to talk about fire safety and this kind of thing. We need to talk about, well, obviously the wildfires are just eating up huge amounts of acreage in California and what, Oregon, Washington, all over the West this year. It's been very, very bad. And a lot of it was, I think most of it was started by things like lightning strikes. And then that, of course, you can't stop. But another one was started, I believe, by pyrotechnics at a gender reveal party. Don't use things like that that are going to throw sparks up into the air. You know, just know that that could create a problem if you're in a really dry area. So we are going to talk about that. And so we've talked before about firewood lays, you know, how you build your firewood when you're having a campfire and how to start a nice fire. But however, I don't think that we have ever talked about just fire safety. Observe all fire safety rules. If you are camping out and it's dry and you're told by the rangers or you're told by even the newspaper that you're not supposed to have outdoor fires at all, listen to them. Don't do it. And when you select your campsite, try to find a campsite near a water source so that you can put the fire out easily when you break camp. And also so that you can put the fire out if it tries to get away from you. Now, bring a broom or a rake. If you hike in, you might have to use that little shovel that we all hate. However you use it, you need to sweep the area. You pick up all of the sticks and twigs that would be easy to start a fire. Pile them up somewhere well away from your fire. And, you know, if you can sweep away leaves, sweep away all the leaf litter and debris away from the area you're going to have your fire in. And you don't want to camp directly under a tree that you might call a widowmaker, a dead, dry, standing tree. You don't want to camp under it. You don't want to camp near it. And one of the reasons, of course, is that if sparks come up from your fire, it would be just very easy for that to catch fire. Now, you can build your fire ring out of rocks, or even better, you can dig a small hole, which is really the better way to do it. You dig a nice pit, and then you put your rocks around the perimeter of it. And, excuse me, and then after the fire, pour water over it to put it out. Make sure that it's a puddle, you know. Don't leave it, just put a little bit over it and walk away. You want to make it like a puddle and then stir it around and then cover it back with dirt. And if you are in a parking camp area, you may not have to be as careful as that, but if you are in a hike-in situation, you should always be. And as dry as it is in places like California, you probably should not have a fire at all, you know, in a hike-in area. Now, this information, we are down to 11 minutes, honestly. We were going to talk about self-defense, but I think we're going to probably finish up the wildfire talk and then begin talking about self-defense tomorrow at 4. Now, this comes from WikiHow, How to Survive a Wildfire, and it was last updated September 3rd. Wildfires are common in hot, dry climates. They can happen anywhere. Most wildfires start small, often from human causes. You know, drop cigarette, for instance. You know, put a cigarette in the fire ring, in with the fire. Put it in a can filled with water, and then dump that in the fire later. But don't ever just smoke something and throw it down outside, especially when it's dry outside. Most wildfires start small, often from human causes, but spread quickly. The ashes and smoke create wind currents low to the ground, which means that a large active fire can throw burning embers up to a mile ahead of the actual fire. If you ever find yourself facing the threat of a fire, it's important to know what to do to ensure that you and your family remain safe. Surviving on foot. Remain calm. The situation is extremely dangerous, but panicking will only hinder your ability to adapt to the situation and survive. Breathing techniques are an excellent way to keep calm if the air is not too smoky. Take a deep breath in for 4 seconds and exhale slowly for 4 seconds. Repeat until you feel more calm and in control. But again, if the air is already smoky, you should not take the deep breaths, and you shouldn't be just standing still either. Remain confident in your ability to escape and survive. Your mental condition will be an important factor in determining your ability to make it out alive. Protect your airways. This is the most important thing you can do to ensure your safety. Even if the fire continues to advance, you still have a chance of escaping if you can breathe. As soon as you start inhaling smoke and carbon monoxide, you're going to pass out, and you'll be passing out and dying, is what it says. Stay low to the ground. Cover your nose and mouth with a wet cloth and hold it there until you get to safer grounds. In the case of having to wear masks, if you have a mask, I would imagine wetting it, getting it good and wet, would help, too, because it helps to catch the particles of carbon and all in the smoke. So, let's see. If you are hiking, you should have water and some type of cloth with you, like a bandana. Pour water over the bandana and use it as a makeshift respirator until you can escape. If the fire gets close and heat rather than smoke becomes your biggest enemy, switch back to a dry cloth. Breathing through a wet cloth does help with smoke, but with a fire nearby, the heat can evaporate the water, making it harder to breathe and possibly damage your airways. Determine 3 courses of action. If time and your mental condition allow it, try to formulate 3 different escape plans. Then you can quickly assess each of the options to find the most advantageous escape route. And if the situation changes and you need to adjust your plans, you'll already have 2 backups. Let me see. I'm trying to remember what the STOP stands for. We talked about it before. You know, stop, think, organize a plan, and then you're putting it into effect, basically. So you have to stop long enough to say, okay, what am I going to do? If you're running around, burning up energy, running in circles, you haven't helped yourself. So you get your 3 courses of action. Remember that the most dangerous places to be in relation to the fire are uphill from the flames and downwind from the fire. Try to stay upwind of the fire at all times. Use the wind as a guide. If the wind is blowing past you and toward the fire, then run into the wind. If the wind is behind the fire and blowing towards you, run perpendicular to the fire so that you're escaping both the actual flames and the course they will blow towards. Remember that winds can carry sparks and start new mini fires up to 1 mile ahead of the existing flames. Do not allow yourself to become surrounded by fire, and that takes a lot of observation. Hid for non-flammable terrain. If at all possible, hid for the nearest, biggest area that is unlikely to burn. While the fire is probably wide and sweeping, it needs combustible material like trees, brush, and tall grass to burn. Look for nearby areas that are free of trees and brush. If you can put a water body between you and the fire, do so. Places which have already burned are sometimes the safest place to go. If you do not have any other options, that would be what you should think about doing. However, you should ensure that the area is completely extinguished before proceeding, as lingering fires could cause burns and breathing problems. So if it looks like it's already burned, but it feels hot and it's, you know, smoke is rising and all, then it's still smoldering. Avoid high burn places. As you flee the fire, you'll need to avoid places that could leave you trapped once the fire advances. If at all possible, avoid areas choked with a lot of vegetation, as these will almost certainly burn. Low-lying areas are generally considered safer if there is not a lot of vegetation there. Stay away from canyons, natural chimneys, and saddle-like ridges. These areas leave very few options if the fire suddenly spreads around you, and a canyon could leave you trapped in a dead end. hunker down if trapped. If the fire surrounds you or there is no place safe to head toward, your safest option may be to hunker down in an area that will not burn. However, if you are able to continue fleeing the fire and heading towards safety, you should do so. If at all possible, take refuge in a building or vehicle. If you are near a body of water like a river or pond, seek safety in the water or use it to keep some distance between you and the fire. Fire will not burn across water unless it is a narrow creek with a lot of overhanging trees. If you are near a road or ditch but cannot follow the road to safety due to the width of the fire, you may be safest using the road as a barrier. Unless there are overhanging branches, the fire will take time to spread across the pavement. If you become trapped, lie face down on the pavement as far from the fire as you can get. If there is a ditch on the fire side of the road, lie in the ditch face down. When you hunker down, try to cover your body with anything that will protect you from the fire. Wet clothing or a wet blanket are useful, but in a pinch, even covering the back of your body with soil or mud may help you to keep you cool in the intense heat. And stay down until the fire passes if you can. Staying safe in a vehicle. You know, that when I saw that on here, I thought, you know, I wondered if that was really what you would do, because you look at these fires, these automobiles in people's driveways and all, when a fire has gone through a neighborhood, and there's nothing there but a frame. You know, everything flammable has burned. And, you know, I wondered how safe someone would be in a car. First of all, find a vehicle. If you are not in your own vehicle and your choices are running on foot or using a vehicle, opt for the vehicle. It's extremely dangerous, but will give you better odds of surviving than being on foot. If you do not have your own vehicle, but find an abandoned vehicle as you flee from the fire, enter the vehicle and hotwire the car. Well, if you know how to. If you need to break a window to enter the vehicle, break a rear window so that the front windows can remain closed. This is important as it will help keep smoke out of the vehicle. Do not break into and hotwire a car that someone is likely to be coming looking for. You should never take someone else's means of escaping the fire. This method is only really it only applies if you find a car that someone clearly left behind to flee on foot. Or maybe they've left in another vehicle. Ensure that you can breathe. Once you're in a car, you'll need to ensure that the car is safely sealed from the smoke around you. This is crucial since you will otherwise risk passing out from carbon monoxide. Roll up the windows and close the air vents. And I guess if you've had to break that window, you should try to cover it somehow. Drive if you can. If the vehicle runs and you're capable of driving it, then do so. But it's important to drive safely so that you can see your surroundings and so that anyone else on the road can see you. Drive slowly and keep your headlights on. Keep an eye out for other vehicles and pedestrians. Stop to let any pedestrians you encounter ride along with you. Do not drive through heavy smoke. If the smoke is too thick to see where you're steering, it may be safer to park and wait it out. If you must stop the vehicle, park as far away from trees and heavy brush as possible. Remain in the vehicle. If the smoke is too thick to see the road, or if you cannot drive the car for any reason, you should remain in the vehicle. You will be more likely to be injured or killed by leaving the vehicle than you would be if you remained inside. And I think we are going to stop there and conclude talking about wildfires and we'll do that tomorrow and talk about self-defense also tomorrow. We're going to start talking about that. If any of you have questions, comments, if you want to give me some ideas, that you might like to hear me talk about, any topics, I would love to hear from you. And even if you just want to email me and talk, that would be fine. My email is all lowercase letters, R-E-V, as in Victor, D-E-B, 1955, @gmail.com. And I would love to hear from you if you have some good ideas. I cover the same material in a year's time. I'm covering the same material. I cover it all, and then I start over, and I try to make something different each time. try to find different articles and talk about different things. But the basics stay the same. You know, you need your hurricane, and that's not over yet, hurricanes and tornadoes. You need your survival supplies. And on my website, survivingintroubledwaters.wordpress.org. No, I think it's .com. I'm sorry. survivingintroubledwaters.wordpress.com. If you go to that website, you will find a whole list of supplies and a whole list of things that may be helpful for you in deciding what you need to purchase. And do a little bit each time you get paid. You know, that's really the best you can do. And if you can find these things that you need around your house, put them together in one place so you can get them in a hurry if something happens. So now, tomorrow at 4 o'clock, I'll be back, and I hope that all of you will continue to come tomorrow and listen to what else I have to say about wildfires. That is certainly becoming a regular season in our country, I think, especially in California, as climate changes and it's getting so very hot and dry now. So I hope you'll be back at 4 p.m. Please get your supplies together. Listen to the international news. You know, hopefully it will never happen, but war could happen. So listen to the news. And also, I wanted to say this, and I didn't get a chance to. September, even though it's almost over, is Child or Baby Safety Month, Awareness Month. So make sure you have masks that fit your babies if you're going to take them out in a food store or any other store around people. Make sure that your small children and your babies also have masks. So until then, I hope that you'll join me tomorrow at 4 as we learn together how to survive the days ahead. Until then, may Father bless. Good night.